tune out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Wednesday, the 18th of March, 2026, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at radioalbion.com. Well, today I thought we could go back to the Unknown Warriors book by Nicholas Pringle. And if you missed the first instalment of this, this is a book that collects together the reminiscences of people who fought in World War II, and they were asked particularly what they thought of Britain today, and their answers are very interesting. And this book was compiled, I think, around about 2007. They just had Tony Blair, and I think they had Gordon Brown at the time, so they had a good few years of New Labour by this point. And a lot of the things that we complain about today as nationalists are the exact same things that these ex-servicemen were complaining about 20 years ago. So it just goes to show you how prescient they were, how wise they were, to be honest, to be thinking about these things and pointing this out. Of course, today we tend to mock our old people, or at least the establishment does. And I think probably the reason for that is because they're sensible. Because they can see what changes have happened to Britain in that time. And they're not happy about it. And I'm not going to tell you the names of the people that actually wrote in. A lot of them wrote in anonymously as well, because they were frightened of reprisals from the things that they actually said. So here's the first quote. "There you have in broad outline two views relating to much of my life. On general lines, I bet that many who respond to your letter in the Epsom Guardian, and no doubt other newspapers, will agree with the following. Moral standards and manners have really worsened, whether on the road, in families, in restaurants, or on the streets. The political correctness of the day has led us into plainly daft administration and government." That's interesting, pointing out political correctness, cultural Marxism. And of course, where that has ended up today is with claiming that men can be women, women can have penises, and all manner of ridiculousness has arisen from this political correctness. Back then, 20 years ago, people had rarely even heard of a transgender. They probably heard of a transvestite, but not a transgender. And today, we're just bombarded with all this transgender propaganda, and we're told it's transphobic to say that women can't have penises. "Any future canvasser on my doorstep will be asked one question. Will you bring to a halt the balminess of today?" Of course, balminess means craziness, ridiculousness, stupidity. "We have given a bountiful home to many people of different faiths, and they seem to be ruling the roost. As an Englishman, I feel I am reduced to the second division. I suppose that I am referring to the total chaos of immigration policy and implementation. I am not allowed to be racist. Others who have made this country their home can be. To continue on these lines would not be politic in this letter. But look at the nonsense recently of a charming public lady wearing a cross. The whole subject beggars belief." Now, I'm not certain what he was referring to there, but I'm guessing that it was somebody being told that they couldn't wear a cross because that would be Islamophobic. It would offend Muslims. So we can see the same things were going on 20 years ago as today. The main problem was immigration policy. And you can see here that he blames the policy itself, the people making the policy. He doesn't blame the immigrants. This idea that nationalists just blame immigrants for everything is a falsehood. It's a straw man. We blame the governments for our immigration policy and for importing these people into our countries. He says, I sometimes simply do not believe what is going on. We really need a bold political party to come to grips with this thing. And this must not result in fascism, just plain common sense and Englishness of the old-fashioned style. And of course, that is what gets referred to as fascism today. Nationalists, ethno-nationalists, that's what he means by Englishness of the old-fashioned style. Englishness, which is to be English. Only the English could come up with Englishness. And of course, today that's equated with whiteness, and we're told whiteness needs to be eliminated. In fact, when they claim that anybody can be English, that what they are doing is erasing Englishness and denying that there is such a thing as being English. Next one here is a little bit longer. It says, while there have certainly been great advances in material standards of life, in many other directions there has been a deterioration. Thinking first of standards of honesty and integrity, much of that deterioration started in wartime. Now, this is quite interesting. There was a terrific amount of what many did not think of as dishonesty, but was certainly theft. Petrol was the basis of much of this. Petrol was always available in quantity, especially to frontline mobile troops, tanks, armoured cars, etc. And there was considerable pilfering and disposal to civilians who were experiencing shortages in the countries we operated and through which we passed. Now, I had never thought about that before. I had heard that there was a black market, obviously, and the people that were still in Britain were selling things on the black market. But the idea that the actual British soldiers were pilfering supplies, such as petrol, so that they could then sell them on in the countries that they were in, I must admit, I had never thought of. I should imagine that there would have been quite a serious punishment for that if they had been caught. I know they had very serious punishments for things like that amongst the German army. Also, there was some bartering of food, which was also in shortage amongst all civilian populations. Tins of bully beef were almost a currency, particularly after the war in Germany, which experienced very grave shortages. Well, after the war, a lot of the Germans were deliberately starved, weren't they? The men were not given the category of prisoners of war. They were considered to be non-combatants, and they put them all in a field with no food and no shelter over the winter, where they had to dig holes and live in holes, and anybody that dared to feed them ran the risk of being shot at by the Allied military. Eisenhower's death camps, that's what they were referred to. I forget the number of people that died. It was over a million people that died of starvation. And it was deliberate starvation. All the aid, all the food aid that there was for them was just being withheld, and it wasn't being fed to them because they wanted to punish the Germans after the war. It's absolutely horrendous. If people look up Eisenhower's death camps, I think they'll find information on it online. So he says here that they were bartering, they were exchanging food after the war, and in Germany it was grave shortages. Wonderful dishes could be produced based on bully beef, and the exchanged commodity was usually sex. There had been a general loosening of standards in sexual behaviour since the war, and this too was largely brought about by wartime conditions. Now, I've heard about after the war with this unconditional surrender, which effectively means that the women can just be raped by the invading army. That's what unconditional surrender means. When Donald Trump says that he will only agree to an unconditional surrender of Iran, that's what it means. It means that the invading army can just do whatever they like. There are no conditions. And if you fight back, then you just be killed. And you're agreeing not to fight back. You're agreeing to surrender without any conditions. And we know that the Red Army in particular, there were hundreds of thousands, possibly over a million women that were raped by the, particularly by the Red Army. And I think this also happened with the American Army and black members of the army, the African Americans. They were disproportionately responsible for a lot of the raping, but no, nobody was prosecuted for it. I think you'll find that there are interviews with Russians talking about the rapes that the Red Army were guilty of, where they are admitting to this going on. You can see that in Dennis Wise's documentary, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told. And I think we did also talk about it in our Truthful Out radio series. Continuing here, it says there has been a general loosening of standards in sexual behaviour since the war, and this too was largely brought about by wartime conditions. People generally became much more mobile in the war, not only service people who were moved around as military situation demanded, both men and women, but there were larger movements of people to meet aircraft and military manufacture. People thus thrown together often found new partners, even if already engaged or married. There was an attitude of living for the day, because one did not know what the next day would bring. This behaviour also carried on into the post-war period. Again, this is something that I hadn't actually thought about. I was imagining that these people that had gone off to war, that they were being faithful to their sweetheart. But according to this eyewitness, he says that wasn't so. And you have to account more weight to somebody like this who is reporting on what they saw as an eyewitness than what somebody may say 50 years later. When looking at historical evidence, it's always the evidence that was produced at the time that has to be given more weight than anything else. And that's particularly important when looking at things like slavery. It's very important to actually look at what was being written about it at the time. Loose sexual behaviour can hardly be a good thing. When the Webbs, recognised as founders of the Labour Party, extolled sexual freedom, they did not state how the products, the births of illicit relations, should be fed and cared for, with the result that now we have a vast number of one-parent families who are a burden on the taxpayer. Not only that, but where you have intellectually liberal elite councils, single mothers are given priority over genuine families awaiting for accommodation. And there's a reason for that, because they will say, well, a single mother can't afford to pay for themselves. What are we going to do? Put them out on the street. That's why we have to give them accommodation. And it's the exact same argument of why they have to give asylum seekers accommodation. They will say, well, this person cannot speak English. He is completely on his own. Nobody is going to rent to him because he is an asylum seeker. Therefore, we have to find them somewhere to live. So it's our empathy which is actually causing a perverse incentive here, because we don't want to make an incentive for people to have children without being married. But there is an incentive in the fact that if they do that, they will be given their own flat. We don't want to make it an incentive for asylum seekers to come over here. But if we end up putting them in hotels and giving them council houses, then there is a perverse incentive for them to do that. And I guess it's always been a perennial problem amongst white people, basically, that some of us pull to the right and some of us pull to the left. And some of us would rather give in to the empathy, and others of us would rather say, well, no, we have to be logical about this. And this is, of course, this is one of the reasons why people in the past would say, well, we need to have a patriarchy, because men think logically. Women think with their emotions. Women are more likely to do things based on their feelings. And men are more likely to do things based on logic and reason. And if you had men in charge, then you wouldn't have a lot of the problems that we have today. But because we put women in charge, and also because we allow women to vote, it means that there's a large portion of our population that votes based on their feelings rather than based on logic. And that's how you end up with situations like this, I think. There is also a great increase in divorce and broken families, which has produced a widespread increase in criminality as the children grow up. Traditional families generally give more stability to children. and are less likely to produce criminals, so the statisticians inform us. And he's entirely correct there. Statistics do show that it is far preferable for children to be brought up in a family than to be brought up with single parents. But of course, today they will skew those statistics, or they'll say that they're biased against women or biased against single parents. They'll even try to produce statistics now to say that you're better off being brought up by two homosexuals of the same sex rather than being brought up by a male and a female. And of course, the best way to be brought up is the natural way. I have both a mother and a father that stayed together, and I never really thought that that was out of the ordinary. But today, it is something out of the ordinary. Most of the people I meet, their parents were divorced. I seem to be in somewhat of a rarity that my parents were both together, and I'm very glad that they did stay together. I think if you have a mother and a father there, you have a really solid foundation on which for the child to grow and to learn. And whenever I talk to people whose parents did split up, they will inevitably say that it was the worst thing that ever happened to them, was when their parents split up. So this was the reason why it was hard to get divorced years ago. It wasn't so that women could be oppressed. It was because the interests of the child were put ahead of the interests of the parents. So he says after the war, there was an increase in divorce. Added to all this is the high publicity given to bed hopping, adultery, and divorce of celebrities. And since the media now give more attention to publicity, to the cult of celebrity, there is a strong pattern for people with ordinary lives who say, why not me? Then, of course, there is the additional pressure of drug taking. Now, I agree with him here about the promotion of sex in the media. And everything just generally goes downhill. It used to be that pornography was considered lewd behaviour. And predominantly Jewish organisations and groups in America lobbied the government and kept going after the government in order to get it seen as a free speech issue so they could then get pornography legalised. And then once that was legalised, you had access to seeing people having sex. Just, well, you'd have to go to a shop, wouldn't you? Or you'd have to go to a cinema. And eventually now, and then it was all on the shelves of the news agents. And now it's all on everybody's screens so they can see it at home. And alongside that has become this massive increase in divorce. So I think you can trace all of this back really to, from what he's saying here, is to the war and this downgrading of people's morality in the war. And when you look at these things, you really have to look over the generations. It's no good just looking at what happens individually at one point. You have to look at what's happening over generations so that you can observe trends and see what the results of those trends are. Now, he's mentioned drug taking here. Then, of course, there is the additional pressure of drug taking. I don't know quite how we have got into the bad state that we are in now. Well, maybe he doesn't know it, but in the 1920s, cocaine and heroin were both available in the shops. I don't even know that you had to go to a chemist. You could go to Harrods and you could buy cocaine and heroin and an injection kit so that you could inject it. Before that, you could buy opium, you could buy laudanum, which was morphine suspended in alcohol. And civilization didn't collapse. You had the Roaring Twenties, in fact, when all these things were legal. And you had the British Empire. The British Empire was even responsible for getting a lot of people addicted to opium, particularly in China. And of course, it was still legal in Britain, but we didn't have any of the problems that we have today. I mean, I would suggest that a lot of the problems related to drug taking today are actually related to the illegality of it, rather than so much of the drug itself. If somebody becomes dependent on a drug and they're physically dependent, they have to have that drug, pretty much the same as you have to eat and drink and sleep. They have to have that drug. How are they going to get that drug if it's extremely expensive and you just buy it on the street? Well, they're going to have to turn to crime to pay for it. And also the changing in the quality of the drug that they get on the street can mean that they can end up easily overdosing and dying. So the acquisitive crime, the burglaries, the muggings, that's down to it being illegal. The overdoses that happen and the people that die from overdoses, that's down to it being illegal. And then, of course, you've got the shootings and the stabbings and the turf wars, and that's most definitely down to it being illegal. So I think most of the problems to do with drugs are due to it being illegal. And, of course, the government or the establishment subtly promote it anyway. They certainly subtly promote cannabis. They might make it illegal on the one hand, but on the other hand, you'll have lots of celebrities talking about it and talking about the benefits of it. Personally, I think if we led interesting enough lives and we had fulfilled enough lives, we wouldn't be tempted to take drugs in the first place. And if you get involved in nationalism, you will have something positive in your life that you can devote your life to, that will give you just as many rewards, more rewards, in fact, than drug taking will. He says, no one seems to be offering any effective solution. I suppose the situation of moneyed people years ago taking drugs, including cocaine, caused less well-off people to try them and so create a demand. Well, that's not quite so. I mean, as I say, there wasn't really a problem. You used to be able to get heroin in Britain, even after the days when you could get it at Harrods. You used to be able to get it on the NHS if you had a heroin addiction. You could just get your heroin from the NHS, and it was referred to as the London method, and they would just reduce the heroin until you were down to zero. And they stopped all that in the 60s. They stopped the London method, or the British method, or whatever it was called, and they said, well, we're not going to give them heroin anymore or morphine, we're going to give them methadone now instead. And the instant that they started giving people methadone, on the streets of Britain, this brown heroin started being sold, which is effectively what the cause of the problem is today, is all of this brown heroin, this street heroin that's being sold. That market was created the minute that they stopped prescribing heroin to users. And of course, once that happened, you then had drug pushers pushing it, and you then had people getting addicted to it that had to find some other way of getting their supply of it. So they ended up becoming dealers themselves. And then you get a self-fulfilling prophecy, and it continues to expand like a snowball. And so you have the situation today where you have whole areas of inner cities that are just filled with smackheads and crackheads, even worse in America. And I see it as all following on from making these things illegal in the first place, really. So he says here, it's caused by less well-off people trying them, and that created the demand. Well, I think what created the demand was making it illegal, and then the people that did have a drug habit had to find some way to keep affording that drug habit, so they would then start selling it themselves, whereas before they would have just got it on the NHS. The downgrading of cannabis was controversial at the time, and now is seen clearly as a mistake, as two headline murders recently were cannabis-related. Drugs and promiscuity both lead to abortion, rape and STDs. And as I say, this is from 20 years ago, and cannabis was downgraded to a Class C. And I think when David Cameron got back into government, when the Conservatives got back in, I think they upgraded it to B. Also, when cannabis was downgraded to C, magic mushrooms were also legalised. And I don't recall there being any problems with magic mushrooms or related to magic mushrooms. But when David Cameron got in, he put the magic mushrooms back up to a Class B as well. I think up to that point, you used to be able to buy magic mushroom kits in shops, and you used to just be able to grow them at home. And then you could consume them, and nothing illegal about it. As I say, it didn't cause lots of problems. But once you make it illegal, then you create a black market, effectively. You create a problem by making these things illegal. The other item, which has done nothing to solve any problems, is, of course, the government. The John Major government, which sadly lowered the standard and was pretty abysmal. Not surprisingly, when it became clear that he had been having an affair with Edwina Curry, the egg woman, I believe Edwina Curry is Jewish. Apart from any other aspects of that, i.e. cheating on a fairly sound and supportive wife, what shocking taste it revealed. Ugh, how awful. Curry, the egg woman. That gave the Labour Party its long and desperately awaited chance and brought into office quite the worst government that we have had in all my years. And again, this is interesting. There is an argument that would say you want men of the people to be in charge of the government. You want people that the general public can relate to. Therefore, you want people that have experienced a little bit of life. So there is this argument. So you could say, well, you want people that maybe they've taken drugs, maybe they've got a criminal record, maybe they've had a few affairs, because then, like, the majority of people that they are governing. But do you want that? Do you really want to be governed by people like yourself, or do you want to be governed by people that are the absolute very best, people that have the absolute very best morals and ethics and have shown so throughout their life, that set the example? And if you look at things in the past, when you had a bad king, a king that was into gambling and alcoholism and not being very good, then people in the country would follow, and they would be not very good, and their morals would be very low. And then when you had a king who was a very good example, people would imitate the king. So there is an argument that if you have people at the top and they're badly behaved, then the people at the bottom are going to be badly behaved. And what that appears to be what he's saying here is saying you have the man at the top and he's having an extramarital affair and he's caught out. I mean, that just sets the example that it's okay to have an extramarital affair, doesn't it? What you really want is somebody that doesn't have an affair, that sets a good example. He says, shortly after this government came into power in 1997, I received a short questionnaire on green, almost flimsy paper from Labour Party head office with Blair's facsimile signature. This mentioned four items with the wording roughly as follows. Do you believe in the best possible health service available at the point of need, good law and order, a really good education system available to all, a much improved good value transport system? It went on to say that these would be the policy and aims of the new government. So would I support them? And would I like to make a contribution to the Labour Party? I have never joined the Labour Party before or since, but I would be querying my own common sense if I answered no to any of those points. So I answered yes to the four, and there was a space for comments, so I wrote, I am not a betting man, but if I was, I would not bet on a horse that had not run before. We now know that not one of these four items has been satisfactorily dealt with in the past 10 years. And when, in addition, we have been taken into military action totally unnecessarily. Blair has the blood of many servicemen on his hands. He has sent our first-class troops into Serbia, Kosovo, and Afghanistan to boost his ego in the hope of appearing as the statesman that he is not. In addition, while he has taken every excuse to travel around the world rather than pay any attention to domestic problems, things have got steadily worse in every direction. The situation of both asylum seekers and immigrants, terrorists, and about half a dozen financial matters are in chaos. So interesting there that he's making reference to asylum seekers, exactly the same problem as we have today. The funding of pension credit, income credit, and the financial state of the country generally is now so desperate that if elderly people need to go into a nursing home, the authorities will do all they can to get their hands on their personal home, for which all too frequently has been something for which they have saved for all their lives. This is the brave new Britain led by Mr. President Blair. When Brown became Chancellor, at the time he was walking on the water alongside Blair. The first thing he did was to deprive the pension funds of their tax credits, amounting to approximately $5 billion each year. Now, those are not in government funds, and once paid in, partly by employers and partly by employees, the funds have belonged usually to trusts nominated by those two bodies. They certainly are not government funds, and Brown had no ethical right to tamper with them. 2 years ago, the city analysts were saying that a big black hole was occurring in the country's finances, and it seems they were right. As one observer said recently, one thing can be said for Gordon Brown, it has taken him longer than any previous chancellor to mess up the country's finances. Of course, Gordon Brown also sold all the country's gold off at rock bottom prices. Some of us, of course, can remember the ground nuts scheme, which turned into a money-burning fiasco. Also the scandal of Dr. Dalton, a Labour Chancellor who revealed some budget plans so that his friends could benefit. The slag heaps scandal during the Harold Wilson government, and the time when Dennis Healey had to go running to the World Bank for a loan because he had brought the economy nearly to bankruptcy, and more recently, the Millennium Dome. In my humble opinion, and the observation of a considerable number of years, I think that the Labour Party couldn't run a booze-up in a brewery. The latest fiasco, announced almost as I write, is that there is an average of a murder a week on our streets by people who are of unsound mind and make the lives of innocent people unsafe. I think it's a lot more than that. I think it's two or three murders a week by now, I think, or at least twice a week we have a murder. Some of us can remember a time when people could walk around at will and quite safely, but that wouldn't be politically correct to say so. After unloading a load of pessimism, I must add a note of optimism. When I see the occasional family complete with two parents, nicely dressed, and the children well-behaved, a brief silver lining appears in my vision. And I think, well, this does not happen very often, but that it does occasionally, at least we didn't do what we did all those years ago, for nothing. And what a positive note to end on there. And that is encouraging when you see a happy family together, enjoying family time together, particularly today without any screens visible, which is a very rare occurrence. Well, thank you very much for listening. I will be back tomorrow with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.